in his devotion to God. He's a man of who seeks to be a man of integrity. He's received the highest praise and accolades from the Lord. Yet we're going to see this morning that he was by far from a perfect man. And we're going to see this man sadly crashing and burning in a serious, serious way. We're going to see in this same David, we're going to see lust and coveting and deceit, adultery and murder. And they all pile into his life. And we'll see what happens. We're looking at this as a warning to us. A warning that if a man like David can fall into sin in this way, then there's a warning here, an example for us to guard ourselves that the same thing doesn't happen to us. It might not be the same scenario as it was with David. It might not be sex stuff. It might not be lust. It could be any number of things. But there's a bit in the Bible where it says, lest anyone thinks he stands, be careful lest he should fall. It's a warning here for us. So let's hear the first bit of the story. It's a long story. It's two chapters in total, chapters 11 and 12 of 2 Samuel. Sarah's just going to read us a little bit of the first part of chapter 11. Thanks, Sarah.
So the reading is from 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 to 17. In the spring, at the time when the kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. She had purified herself from uncleanness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David, saying, "I am pregnant." So David sent this word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants, and did not go down to his house. When David was told, Uriah did not go home, he asked him, "Haven't you just come from a distance? Why didn't you go home?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." Then David said to him, "Stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it, he wrote, "Put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so that he will be struck down and die." So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite was dead.
Wow. What I want to do this morning, as we lead to share the bread and the wine together and remember our Lord, is to look at this passage, some of the things here and in the verses that follow as well. And I want to pick out four points of danger that I hope will help us Four warning signs, if you like. There should be a PowerPoint in the thing, Chris, and that's going to come up. So we're going to look this morning. This is where we're going to get to, that David was a man who also had a contrite heart. You know what contrite means? It means a sorry heart. But it took a while for him to get there. Prevention is better than cure. I'd much rather we be prevented, that you be prevented from having to walk through the way that David did, than try and pick up the pieces afterwards. So there are warning signs in here, things that we can see, and if you like traffic lights, that when we get to some crossroads in our lives, they should be points that cause us to think, well, what's going on there? I need to think about this. So the first one we're going to think about is, and this still isn't working, Chris, can you move us on for me? The first one is the what I'm going to call the crossroads of familiarity. The first line of that passage is really significant. Did you notice what it said? In the spring, at the time when the kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army, but David remained in Jerusalem. It was the time that normally the kings went off to war. That was their custom, but this year, David didn't go. He'd done so every previous year from what we can understand, but for some reason, this year he doesn't go. We need to think, is there a reason? Can we discern the reasons why he doesn't go? We don't know for sure, but I think there are a few clues if we understand the whole life of David. David at this point was about 50 years old. So he was, give or take, he was my age. He's not old, but neither was he young. He's got a large family by this stage. He's been king for a long time. He's got responsibilities of family. He's got responsibilities for the whole nation. He's not a young man. And maybe he realizes that there are younger guys that have got more energy than him. Maybe, I wonder if he's starting to think, this is a young man's game. I can't be out there doing that. I wonder if he'd just wanted some time for himself. I've been doing this for years. I'm a good king and I give myself, I just need a break. I need some time. He'd got everything he needed. And it says in chapter 12 that had he wanted anything more from God, if he needed anything more, God would have given it to him. Chapter 12, verse 7. If you need anything more, I would have given it to you. So he's got everything he needs. He's middle-aged. He's not as young as he was. I wonder if this was the first midlife crisis recorded for us. I just wonder if it was. If it could happen to David, everything is steady, family steady, country steady. He's not young, he's not old, he's comfortable, perhaps comfortable in his, and yet he's not. I wonder if the excitement and the buzz of life had left. I wonder if his relationships at home weren't what they used to be. I wonder if he was a middle-aged married man and the thrill of his relationship with his, I'd like to say wife, but I can't, it was wives. Therein lies another story. But I wonder if the thrill of that had become familiar. I wonder if he was bored. And I wonder, you see, he was on his bed instead of out on the battlefield. It wasn't because he was ill, because of what follows on. And on the roof, he saw a beautiful woman bathing. If he was satisfied with life, if he was happy in his relationship, if he was committed and driven with the other things of life, what was he doing looking at another woman and taking the initiative to go and find out who she was and asking her in? I think we've got here the symptoms of a man who's bored, a man whose excitement of life had gone, who wants to, you know, see if he can do it again, see if he can still be attracted, see if he's still got what it takes, and all of those things. You know, as I've It's a dangerous time in life when we get settled down, when we come familiar, when maybe we come bored with how things are. It's a dangerous time. It's a dangerous time when we're not at work and we've got to fill our time with things, when we're not doing what we should do, and when we've got time to look around and look at things and think about things that we shouldn't do. And it's not just young guys, it's not just middle-aged guys. I've seen it time and again in when people retire. And some of you are at retirement age and beyond retirement age. Guys, ladies, as you come up to retirement, guard yourselves carefully because it's a time of transition. It's a time of change. It's a time when you can end up wanting to do things because you don't know where you are. You don't know where you fit in. Ladies, when the children leave home sometimes, what's my role? What am I? My identity was being a mum. My identity was being a carer. What am I now? What have I got left now? In those situations, the mind can go off and you start to look for other things. The crossroads of familiarity. You know, when we see those crossroads, if you go up to a crossroads, you see the lights. I wonder what colour light you think this would be. I want to suggest that here is a big yellow amber light. We see and we sense this time in our lives. We need to, whoa, stop. You know the amber light, what it means? It means slow down, get ready to stop. Slow down and get ready to stop. If we get bored, we need to be careful. It's a warning sign. If we get familiar, if we start to get itchy feet at work, at home, even in church, it's a warning sign. So that's the first one, the crossroads of familiarity. The second one, if you can put it on, Chris, I'm going to call the crossroads of temptation. I want to suggest that this is another amber warning light for us. Here he is in bed instead of in battle. In the home when he should have been out with the men. I'm not being sexist here. I'm simply saying, suggesting that he shouldn't have been there. Had he been doing what he should have been doing, he would have not been in a position of seeing Bathsheba bathing on a nearby rooftop. Not doing what he should have been doing meant that he was vulnerable and he's now in a position of direct temptation. He shouldn't have been looking and he absolutely shouldn't have been texting. Well, they didn't have text those days, but he sent a message. Messaged, go and find out who she is. And then he brings her in. The message comes back. This is Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Where's the clue of the danger here? This is Bathsheba, the, you know, huge flashing lights here. This is a married woman. David, I'm saying this is a yellow light. This should have been a red light, really, shouldn't it? Chris, pop the light up for us. I put an amber, but thinking about it, it should have been a red. It should have been David. This is, you just don't go there. Married woman. You know, sometimes when temptation comes, temptation itself is a place of danger. When we feel tempted, when we feel tempted, we need to be careful. You can't avoid temptation sometimes. You can't avoid temptation. That's why I've put it as an amber light. When there's temptation, whatever it is, comes into your life, and you're tempted to do something that you know is wrong, you've got to be careful. It's an amber light to warn you to slow down, get ready to stop soon. To carry on will be dangerous. When he gets the message that she's a married woman, it should have turned immediately to red. And he should have stopped. How do we face temptation? You know, then conscience starts to come. David risked everything by not stopping. You know, when a friend warns us about the danger of what we're doing, when your conscience speaks and warns you against what you're doing, what you're thinking, what you're allowing yourself to give time to, don't ignore it. I don't know if you're ever like me. I've got to admit, sometimes I see an amber light at the light at the traffic lights, and instead of stopping, I put my foot down because I think I'm going to beat it. I'm not proud of it. I do it. When the amber light comes on, we've got to be careful. We don't reason it away. We don't think, I'll beat it. We've got to stop and we've got to think. As I say, so that's the second crossroads. Now, David should have stopped. He risked everything. And sure enough, a few weeks later, the message comes back. David, I'm pregnant. Now, how will David respond? Because I'm going to suggest this is the third crossroads. How will David respond now that the results of his sin are running out of control, which they do? I'm going to talk about the crossroads of consequence, when the consequences start to show. And I'm going to say to you that this is a red light. When the consequences show, it's a big red light for us. You see, David, at this point, when it's clear that he can't just pass over this thing, there's consequences here of his action, he should have stopped. He should, at that point, have confessed to God what he'd done. He should have admitted to Bathsheba and Uriah. He should have said sorry. He should have done the proper thing. Yes, it would have been hard. It would have been incredibly embarrassing. It would have been painful, but it would have been infinitely better than doing what he chose to do. Because instead of confessing, instead of facing up to the reality, he hit the panic button again and he tries to cover up what he'd done. He's sneaky and he's crafty. He brings Uriah back from the battlefront and tries to get him to spend a night with his wife. So that when the pregnancy is known, well, it was Uriah. Because you remember he spent that night back home? Uriah doesn't do it. He won't do it. So David then proceeds to get Uriah drunk. Think, I'll get him drunk. Then he won't be thinking quite so clearly. So that he'll go home, spend the night with his wife, get David off the hook. Still Uriah won't. I think there's a great irony here. That even drunk, Uriah, the Hittite, is more honourable in his dealings with people than a sober David. That's a salutary thing there. In desperation, David works out a conniving little plan to have Uriah killed, to make it look like an accident. One thing just leads to another. He sees, he covets, he commits adultery, he lies, he ends up as a murderer. It's a sad and sorry saga, and still David isn't finished. Because with Uriah killed, he continues what I think is his grubby little plan by making himself look all noble, and, well, he'll provide a home for this widowed lady who's going to have a baby. So he'll take her in. David, how noble of you, how kind of you, how gracious of you, how thoughtful. And all through, he's just covering things up, hoping that no one will find out. A year goes by. But if we had time, I would take you through what happened for David in that year. During that year, he carries this guilty secret and his soul withers. Outwardly he prospers, but inwardly he withers. The Psalms that he wrote at that time describe his lack of peace, his lack of joy, his lack of life. He's a sick man. And all because of his guilt. That's what sin does to us. The wages of sin is death. A year later, David suddenly comes to the fourth crossroads. The fourth and I think final chance for him to do something about it. You see, until this point, this is in chapter 12, which we didn't read. But what happens here is David, as far as he knows, he's got away with it. Nobody knew. But the end of chapter 11 tells us that somebody did know. It tells us that God knew. The thing that David had done displeased the Lord. And God sends a man named Nathan to talk to David. not because he hated David, but because he loved David and he wanted better things for him. He cared for him. And in a wonderfully sensitive yet to the point and blunt honesty, Nathan confronts David with what he's done with a story about a rich man and a poor man. The rich in a town, there was a rich man who has pretty much everything. There's a poor man who all he has is a little lamb. And he loved that lamb, and the lamb, the story goes, as Nathan tells him, the man loved that lamb. He fed it hand by hand. He had it in the house. At night, it slept in his bed. It was the most precious thing he had. One day, a visitor comes into the town and goes to stay with the rich man who has everything. And the rich man looks around and says, I need to give him some food. I need to give him a decent meal. And so instead of going into his larder, instead of going to kill one of his animals to cook for the meal, guess where he goes? He goes to the poor man. And he takes the lamb, the sheep that this man was so fond of, and uses it to provide the meal for his visitor. David, as he listens to the story, is enraged. He can't do that. That's not fair. Show me who that man is, and I'll sort him out. That man deserves to die. And Nathan says, David, that man is you. Because that's what you have done. You have everything, and yet you saw Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah. You have got everything. Uriah, this was his precious wife, and you wanted her and you took her. You didn't think about Uriah in that situation. You just took her. David, you're the man. Here's the crossroads. What's he going to go and do? You see, Chris, can we pop up this one? Crossroads of exposure. What he's done has been exposed. He could have done what King Saul used to do. If you remember back, King Saul ultimately rejected God. He came up against amber lights and red lights. Never once did he turn back to God. He got embittered and ended up going to seek out help with mediums and spiritualists. Just turned away from God. David could have done that. He could deny it. He could kill Nathan. He could run and seek escape. Or he could confess what he'd done and admit it. Thankfully, in the story, and as the events run on, we see that David admits what he's done. His heart that had been cold and calculating is melted, and he says, I have sinned. I've sinned. I cannot deny it. I've done wrong. I am sorry. And instead of running, he stops. Instead of minimizing what he's done, he admits it, and he accepts his guilt. If you want to know how he felt, read Psalm 51. In that psalm, David pours out his heart. He says, God, it's against you and you only have I sinned. Restore to me the joy of my salvation. And he admits fully, just read it. It's a heart-wrenching psalm. But it was written very shortly after David's sin with Bathsheba was exposed. He was a broken man. We will see in the future there were consequences of this. But here's the thing. His response to God's word ultimately showed that despite his great and many failings in this instance, he was still a man dedicated to God. He was ultimately, despite the failings and the faults that he'd demonstrated, despite the rebellion that he'd committed, despite the fact he'd done so many awful things, he was still a man that basically wanted the glory of God and was willing to serve him. He'd failed hugely. There would be consequences. But when, and here's the thing for us, when he turned back to God, when he said that he was sorry, when he admitted what he'd done, God forgives him. And this is ultimately then another story. of God's wonderful grace and mercy to us. There are warning signs for us, which I've tried to flag up. Familiarity, temptation, consequence, exposure. What do we do when those things happen? There are warning signs for us. Sometimes we fail. Sometimes we fall. This is not to minimize the seriousness of sin. It's not to say it doesn't matter. It does matter. It mattered to David. And as I will show you in a few weeks' time, there were consequences to this. But when we turn back to God, God is like the father of the son that ran away, who was there waiting with open arms to welcome him back, running out towards him to welcome him back and saying, I'm glad you've come back. Here's the ring. Here's the feet. Here's the coat. Come on. We're going to have a party because the son that was lost has returned. And that's how God sees us as well. We must not minimize the seriousness of sin, but even when we fall as far and as deliberately as David did, he made the choices. This was a deliberate act of David. Even in that situation, there was still forgiveness with God. We cannot fall too far then. This is what it teaches us. We cannot fall so far as to be out of the reach and beyond the forgiveness of God. And so the question for us as we finish and as we come to communion is not simply have we sinned, because we've all sinned. We've all fallen short of the glory of God. It's not even how badly have you sinned. It's not even for how long have you been sinning. It's not even how rebellious have you been. The question for us this morning is, will we admit that sin? Will we confess it to the Lord? Will we come back to him? Will we see the danger signs in our lives and stop before we hurt others, before we hurt ourselves? I wonder if there are some of us here this morning, as we've talked this through and we're realizing we're faced with some amber warning lights. Will you heed the warning and do the right thing? Stop before you do something that you'll regret. Stop before you sin against the Lord. Don't plow on. It will be painful if you do. Maybe you're feeling the conviction of the Holy Spirit that says you are the man. You're the woman. It's not other people. You can't keep blaming them. You're the person. You've got a responsibility here. What do? We don't run. Don't hide. But as we come to the table where we remember our Lord Jesus and his death on the cross, where he died to take the blame, to take the punishment, that we might be forgiven. As we come now to take this, God says, just stop and come back to me. Admit what you've done. Confess it. And when David did, that instant, the word came from the Lord through Nathan. The Lord has taken away your sin. So there's two things here this morning. There's warnings for us, so that we don't get into the mess that David got into. Some of us may need those for today. Others of us we all need to store those things up so we're equipped when we're faced with those situations and circumstances. But there may be others who are there in the midst, and we see that sin. Today is the day to stop, to turn around, admit what we've done, come back to the Lord. And as we come to the table this morning, we have to come humbly. We have to come genuinely. We have to come acknowledging, but for the grace of God, there go I. And this is a time when we can do that. So we're going to sing a song, and then